Happy 4th of July. It's midday, the fireworks aren't until tonight. And if you're looking for a break from the standard holiday programming, you're in the right place. We're taking a look at why the systems we rely on, from the NBA to the federal government, are currently feeling a little more like a house of cards than a stable foundation. The NBA's front offices are currently navigating the league's new second apron rules. Teams like the Boston Celtics, for instance, are offloading rotation players to manage the punishing financial and roster-building constraints of the new collective bargaining agreement. It's not a lack of basketball IQ, it's a structural reality. Organizations are choosing to dump salary rather than deal with the tax penalties that come with keeping a high-priced roster intact. It's a complicated situation for the league. We're seeing teams in the middle of the pack get squeezed, which is creating a high-volatility environment where the traditional build-through-the-draft model is being tested against the reality of these new spending caps. Some teams, like Minnesota, are doubling down on talent despite the risk, while others seem to be throwing assets at the wall to see what sticks. It's high-volatility chaos, and it makes the old way of building a roster look like a relic from a different century. This isn't just happening on the court. In the tech world, the playbooks are being rewritten in real time. Enterprise startups are ditching the idea that you need to build your own frontier AI model. Instead, they're using open weights models and pouring that capital into forward-deployed engineers. These aren't your typical sales reps. These are engineers working inside a client's business to stitch autonomous agents into messy, regulated legacy systems. The math is brutal. If your token spend is hitting 20% of your engineering payroll, you're basically running a utility company. Founders who aren't getting into the weeds, what the industry is calling founder mode, are going to get left behind. It's about ditching the slide decks for board memos and hiring people who can use these AI tools to squeeze out 20x productivity. The advantage isn't in the model anymore. It's in the architecture and the ability to integrate that intelligence into a real functioning business workflow. So how do you actually sell this stuff in a world where everyone is skeptical of the next big thing? You stop the polished marketing. We're seeing a shift where founders are building vulnerability moats. They're documenting the messy middle, the pivots, the operational disasters, the stuff that usually ends up on the cutting room floor. It sounds counterintuitive, but it works. Modern audiences have a built-in bullshit detector for curated perfection. By sharing the failures and the high-stakes decisions in public, founders are turning passive consumers into active participants. You can copy a piece of software, or a pricing model, or even a marketing strategy, but you can't copy a history of shared struggle. That's the vulnerability moat. Once an audience is emotionally invested in the evolution of your brand, not just the glossy final product, they're a hell of a lot harder to poach. There's a common thread here that's pretty uncomfortable for the traditionalists. Whether you're an NBA GM navigating a salary cap or a software founder trying to survive an AI pivot, the old-school authority model is dead. The NBA teams that are winning aren't the ones trying to project stability. They're the ones aggressively exploiting the market inefficiencies created by other teams' fear. The enterprise software companies winning aren't the ones selling a vision from on high. They're the ones putting their engineers in the trenches with the customer. And the founders who are actually building loyalty aren't the ones with the slickest PR firm. They're the ones who are honest enough to show the cracks in the foundation. It's less about growth and more about structural survival. We are moving away from an era of frictionless, infinite scaling and into a period where your edge comes from how you handle the friction. You have to be willing to be vulnerable, willing to be technical, or willing to be the only one in the room making a move when everyone else is scared of the tax bill. It's not disruption. It's just building things that are hard to replicate because they're actually human or actually functional. And honestly, that's a hell of a lot more interesting than another slide deck. Speaking of that friction, it's not just tech or sports struggling to maintain a coherent identity right now. It's everyone in a position of power. Leadership experts are currently diagnosing a massive collapse in authority, both in the workplace and online. Jason Redman argues that leadership failure stems from a gap between a leader's actions and their expectations for others. Simultaneously, Vittorio Angeloni notes that public figures are increasingly treating their own identities as a marketing performance to survive digital reputation volatility. Redman's premise is that the majority of leadership is internal. If you aren't mastering your own discipline, structure, and mindset, you're just a manager issuing directives. And eventually, that hollow authority falls apart when things get tough. It's a classic do as I say, not as I do situation. And it's a shitty way to run an organization. Once a team realizes the leader blames external factors for their own failures, they stop following. The influence simply evaporates. Then you look at the digital side of things, and the situation gets even weirder. Angeloni points out that the internet has turned authenticity into a performance art. Instead of being genuine, creators are reverse engineering relatability to fit a brand profile. It's a feedback loop where audiences and creators treat each other like ideological tools. If you don't signal the right tribal loyalty, you get hit with a cringe label, which is just a fancy way of saying your brand has been declared toxic. Here's the tension. Redman says you need to build internal rigor to buffer against crises, while Angeloni says the digital landscape is actively punishing that kind of spontaneous, honest communication. People are so terrified of tripping over invisible social tripwires that they're retreating into safe, boring takes, or worse, calculated vulnerability. It's a disaster for actual human connection. Honestly, it's a lot of pressure to be a person right now. Whether you're a CEO or a content creator, the environment is pushing you to be a caricature. Redman wants you to focus on self-regulation so you don't collapse under pressure. But Angeloni is basically saying the digital world doesn't want you to be regulated. It wants you to be a polarized, performative mess. The interesting part is where these two perspectives meet. Both identify that trust is effectively dead in systems that prioritize optics over substance. Redman says you can't earn influence without personal accountability. And Angeloni says the only way to escape the digital grind is to move toward unreplicable, real-world human connections. If you're a leader, the path forward seems to be a defensive one. Stop trying to optimize for the algorithm or command through empty directives. It's clearly not working. You either put in the work to actually be a disciplined human being, or you're going to get steamrolled by the feedback loop. Anyway, that's where we are. We're in a moment where being yourself is the most dangerous thing you can do for your career. And yet, it's the only thing that actually keeps the wheels from falling off. It's a hell of a paradox. You can either perform your way into a brand that everyone will eventually get tired of, or you can do the boring, internal work that actually makes you worth listening to. Most people seem to be choosing the performance, which is exactly why everything feels so brittle. And when you zoom out, that brittleness isn't exactly a new development for the American experiment. The founder's reliance on classical virtue norms was an attempt to build a stable foundation. But it was also a system that relied on the moral character of those in charge, a theme that echoes our current crisis of hollow authority. The American founders didn't invent a government from scratch. They built the U.S. system by synthesizing ancient Greek and Roman philosophy, explicitly using the decline of the Roman Republic as a warning to avoid the pitfalls of monarchy. Washington, Adams, Jefferson, and Madison relied on these classical touchstones to establish norms, like the stoic dignity of the presidency and the importance of peaceful power transitions. Here's the thing. They were also hypocrites. They weaponized those same classical frameworks to justify slavery, weaving white supremacy into the constitutional fabric, while citing ancient precedents where the practice wasn't race-based. It created a systemic moral debt that we are still very much paying off today. The health of that system, according to the historical record, didn't rely on the design being perfect. It relied on the leaders. Washington succeeded by recognizing his own gaps and surrounding himself with people like Hamilton. John Adams, by contrast, tried to mentor himself, often mirroring the flaws of the very idols he studied. When you lose sight of the reasons behind political norms, you stop having guardrails. And when you don't have guardrails, you're just waiting for someone to drive the whole thing off a cliff. Which brings us to the Reconstruction era. If the founding was the blueprint, Reconstruction was the first time the system actually had to survive a hostile executive. President Andrew Johnson wanted a quick, hands-off restoration of the South, which essentially meant letting white supremacy and agricultural serfdom stay in place. Frederick Douglass and the Radical Republicans fought him on it, arguing that without the ballot, emancipation was basically window dressing. The tension boiled over when Johnson commissioned Carl Schurz to report on the South. Johnson wanted a justification for his leave-it-alone policy, but Schurz returned with evidence of widespread lawlessness and systemic violence against freed people. That gave Congress the leverage to override the president, pass the 14th and 15th Amendments, and force a radical, federal-led reconstruction of state governments. It was a massive, if fragile, success. Thousands of black officials were elected, and the first public education systems were born. But there's a hell of a contradiction here. The founders built a system on classical virtue, but they used it to codify racism. Then, the Reconstruction era proved that the only way to fix those foundational flaws was through aggressive federal intervention. A direct challenge to the states' rights arguments the founders themselves often leaned on. Douglass hit the nail on the head back then. A government that relies on the assumption that good men will always be in charge is a government that's just waiting for a bad man to break it. That is the reality we're living in. We spend way too much time worshiping statues and not enough time wrestling with the fact that these institutions aren't self-executing. They aren't going to save themselves. If you don't know the first principles that built your house, you're never going to know which parts are worth defending and which parts are just rot that needs to be torn out. We're currently at a point where we've lost the historical touchstones that keep the system intact. And honestly, that's a shitty position to be in. Our institutions aren't magic. They are just philosophy turned into work. And right now, the work is lagging. Finally, before you get back to the holiday, here are a few quick takes. If you're playing Fantasy Premier League, stop hoarding your transfers like they're gold bullion. You can't roll them over into the knockout stages, so you might as well burn all four slots to prep for the immediate games. Don't get cute. Just play the board in front of you. There's a long-standing theory that chopsticks evolved from cooking tongs, eventually migrating from the pan to the plate, as populations grew and food needed to be cut into smaller pieces to cook faster. It's a common explanation for why they became the standard utensil in parts of East Asia, though food historians still debate the exact timeline. And finally, the WNBA is finding out the hard way that if you don't steer the conversation, the internet will do it for you. By staying silent on the Caitlin Clark discourse, the league let the loudest, most exhausting parts of the culture war drown out the actual basketball. It's a classic case of hoping an issue goes away, which, spoiler alert, it never does. That's the briefing for today.